Okay, so welcome to the grand finale, the final lecture in this series on the Millennium Prize problems. And we are very grateful for KITP for hosting this event at KITP. Our speaker today really needs no introduction. greatly honored and delighted to have Nobel Laureate, former director at KITP, Professor David Grouse, who's going to tell us about his perspective on the Millennium Problem, Yamil's theory. Okay.
Well, when I was asked to do this, it was, what, a year ago or something? It was one of these invitations that so far in the future you say, sure. And then a few days ago I started to think, what the hell am I going to tell these mathematicians about quantum field theory? So I wrote a talk, and then I tore it up and wrote another one last night. And since it's a math talk, I'll use a blackboard. And since it's at the KITP, if there are any questions, stop me, ask them. So this is, I guess, you've already solved the other six problems. And today's subject is probably the hardest, or at least that's what Edward Witten tells me, of the seven Millennium Prizes. Now, Arthur Jaffe, who's an old friend and colleague of mine, when he started putting together the Clay Foundation, before he was fired, he had a brilliant idea of how to get a lot of publicity, as you know, for the Clay Institute, I think it's called, by formulating prizes that would be announced at the beginning of the millennium, that he would, you know, the Clay Foundation would get a lot of publicity and arouse a lot of interest in mathematics and maybe even in these problems, but not have to pay any money. And so far they've been very successful. They got millions of dollars worth of publicity and only had to pay out one prize to somebody who maybe they even knew wouldn't accept it. So. So it's cost them nothing, but it clearly has aroused a lot of interest. And two of the prizes, remarkably, I mean, some of us physicists were surprised that two of the seven prizes were in physics. One of them being, as you know, the Navier-Stokes equations. Seven, I gather, four different formulations of that prize. And that it certainly hasn't been solved yet. And then a prize for the proof of the existence and a mass gap in non-abelian Yang-Mills theory, or which is no surprise given that Arthur Jaffe was one of the president of the Clay Institute at the time and Edward Witten on their board. This, you know, is a prize that a problem that is even hard to formulate. I mean, you could state what they said, which I think I don't even have. It's roughly to prove the existence of Yang-Mills theory and non-abelian gauge theory in four dimensions for an arbitrary gauge group, and to prove the existence of a mass gap. But even to explain what that prize is takes more than a one lecture and probably a full course. I'm going to give a very limited realize that to really explain even what the problem is, is can't really be adequately done in an hour or a semester. But I'll try to give some perspective on it. But I would like to say a few words, just from the point of view of a physicist who was educated in a period where mathematics, where a lot of these ideas that formed the basis for this prize were being developed, but the attitude towards mathematics was quite different. One of my mentors, Murph Goldberger at Princeton, wrote in a famous book he wrote on dispersion relations, which were an alternative and even more opaque approach to problems now addressed by quantum field theory. He wrote that mathematics is an interesting intellectual sport, but it should not be allowed to stand in the way of obtaining sensible information about physical processes. Which, by and large, is the attitude, or at least used to be the attitude of most physicists. And it did allow us to get awfully far on rather flimsy foundations. Foundations are still pretty flimsy, and that's since the essence of this problem. The problem is asking for, let's see, you actually have the formulation of the problem someplace. You included it in the abstract. But roughly speaking, in words, it's the existence, in the sense of quantum field theory, of Yang-Mills theory, in four dimensions. So in four dimensions with a gauge group G, an arbitrary semi-simple gauge group G, plus a finite mass gap. Now, gauge theories are examples of quantum field theories, the ones we use to describe nature via the standard model, in four dimensions have never been proven to exist. In fact, I'm not even sure that non-trivial, except for very special cases of enormous symmetry, quantum field theories have been of any kind have been proven to exist. So this is not like a problem that, a more complicated problem of where there are examples of what an existence proof would consist of. And the attempts in the past, I must say, have coincided with another quotation of my mentor, Goldberger, where he discussed proofs of dispersion theory, which he said are like man's teats, neither useful nor mental. And by and large, that has always been my attitude towards proof of the existence of quantum field theory. If you actually look at the literature on what has been proven for rather trivial quantum field theories, it certainly don't have the richness of this that allows for the second step. They are ugly and useless. And, well, so many of my colleagues, I must admit, aren't that excited about this Clay Prize. Yeah. No. No, because you're not really sure what it is you're talking about. Besides which, existence is a little. Right. Well, if you don't worry about all those details which we regard as sort of essential for describing the real world, and our, you know, then it's easy. So it's trivial. Yeah. I mean, you know, the mathematics is neither beautiful nor useful. I mean, none of the techniques, I mean, a lot of people have done an incredible amount of work on trying to prove the existence. And I'm not going to say too much about this since I find it so turgid myself, but I will say a bit. And it just, the reason this prize as formulated is, I think, of great interest. After putting it down, I'll say why it is of interest, is twofold. One of these theories that we're talking about are, you know, the theory, the standard model, the theory of elementary particles, well tested, and it's in some sense the best physical, most complete, ambitious, successful theory we've ever had. We'd like to know that it's based on solid foundations. That's one. But we sort of know it is. I mean, physicists do have ways of discovering truth, which isn't, you know, as I said in my first quote, which isn't guided solely by mathematical rigor. If first part of this problem, it's hard to know how this would fail, since it's hard to know what it would mean to prove the non-existence of quantum field theory. You could not succeed in proving it, as people have for many years. Yes, and that indeed is one of the issues. And I'll say a word about that, but not in great detail, because this involves much too much background. But it would be possible to prove the existence of, say, the continuum limit of a well-defined way of defining Yang-Mills theory, and to show that it did not have a finite mass gap. So it would be possible to come up with a negative result here for the combined problem. And that, of course, would shock us all, since we know it's false. But our evidence is based on a way of thinking that many mathematicians find difficult to absorb. And when I started to think about how to give a lecture like this, I went back and looked at the attempt that Ed Witten and others at the Institute did an experiment 10 years ago in Princeton to try to educate, to try to teach a bunch of mathematicians quantum field theory and string theory. 18 years ago? Oh, it's actually, just before I left Princeton. I even lectured in that on a normalization group, and the students, like David Kajlan, who took my class, rewrote the lecture notes, and I couldn't read them. I couldn't understand them afterwards. It was impossible. More or less, anyway. It was not greatly successful because, you know, we think in a way that's based on, you know, sort of walking on a rope over a precipice without looking down. And I get pretty far that way because of the successful history of physics, the fact that we have nature to guide us. So we sort of know that these things are correct, for sure, based on lots of internal consistency, analog examples in other simpler cases in physics, and an experiment. Okay, that's why it still might be interesting. So if one were to find a counterproof of a finite mass gap here, it would be a total shock. And, you know, I'll take strong bets against it. $1 million, say? But But more interesting, I think, is the feeling that if the mathematics could be developed to answer such questions, that given the beauty of the theory, as physicists see it, those methods, if they were powerful enough to answer these questions, would have to be both beautiful and useful. But it's clear nobody has really good ideas, as far as I can see, or the mathematical tools. And so the prize might be useful in pushing mathematicians to develop those tools. And they probably will be very different than anything that's been tried so far. So I have to tell you a bit about gauge theories. And the one gauge theory I'm sure you know about is electromagnetism, which was the first field theory in which there were dynamical objects that were functions, if you want, of space and time, and could be measured, could influence other objects. And Maxwell's theory of electricity and magnetism is based on what we call a gauge theory for historical reasons, an abelian gauge theory, based on the gauge group U1, its dynamical field is a connection on a U1 bundle over Minkowski space. So space and time, four-dimensional space with a Lorentzian signature. And the physical observables are the field strengths. So this is a one form. And the field strength, which is just dA, is a two form whose components are the familiar electric fields and magnetic fields. So Maxwell unified electricity and magnetism into this theory, whose equations of motion are simple by definition, second order PDEs, which follow from an action principle, which is just the integral over space of this curvature of this connection, squared or. Now, Maxwell's equations were the first field theory invented. And that concept of having dynamics described by a function of space and time, like a magnetic or electric field, has dominated physics ever since. It was also the first theory whose equations of motion, whose action is invariant under Lorentz transformations, SO3-1, the isometry of this Minkowski space with flat metric. These linear equations have wave solutions, which Maxwell discovered are just light, are the waves of ripples in this field strength, governed by Maxwell's equations. So in the absence of sources, charges, Maxwell's equations in the vacuum are very simple, easily soluble, describe linear waves that pass through each other, don't interact, traveling at the speed of light. And all the theories that we'll discuss here, Ying Mills theories, are generalizations of that. So this is the dynamical variable, this connection, field strength. In this action, there is a constant here, which plays no role classically, since it doesn't affect the equations of motion, but is known as the electric charge. And if we introduce objects that transform non-trivial under this gauge group, carry electric charge, they will be related to the electric charge of that field. But we're just going to discuss vacuum solutions. And classically, this charge is irrelevant. Now, at the classical level, the theory is very simple. Linear equations, very symmetric. It actually has a bigger symmetry group than Lorentz transformations because of the lack of any scale, explicit length scale here. So since we're going to be talking about masses and couplings, we say a word about units. You know, in physics, you always need to specify the units of the physical objects you're talking about. They're objects that can be measured. You measure things, you measure, you compare them to some meter stick, you measure length, you measure time, some counts of some clock, beats, and you measure energy or mass. So MKS, meter, kilogram, second, CGS, etc. You need, in physics, always to specify the units. We do so, of course, with anthropomorphic units. But in fundamental physics, we tend to use units in which at least two of the basic dimensionful constants of nature appear. One is the velocity of light, and the other is Planck's action, which has units of mass times length squared divided by time. And we can define units in which these are one, and regard these as units of time, and of get rid of two of these fundamental units, express everything. All velocities are fractions of the velocity of light, which is one in these units. All actions, mass, times velocity times length, are also Planck expressed in units of Planck's constant, which plays a fundamental role in quantum mechanics. Sometimes we complete this with another unit, but we won't hear the natural unit being Newton's constant, which defines the unit of mass. But we're not going to be discussing gravity at all. So using units like this, it means that everything is expressible as a length. Okay, time is a length divided by the velocity of light. So now it's easy to see that the correct dimension for the gauge field is 1 over length. And for the electric field or the magnetic field, which has an extra derivative, 1 over length squared. And so you see F has dimensions of 1 over length to the fourth. A volume integral has dimensions of length to the fourth. And therefore, this parameter here, the charge, is dimensionless in these units. The way we normally say it is that the electric charge squared over h bar c, Planck's constant divided by the velocity of light, is dimensionless. So e squared has dimensions of h bar c, but setting them to 1, and is a number, is usually, as defined physically, 1 over 137.0 something. Zero, three, five, bum, bum, bum. So it's a small number, and it's dimensionless. And so you see in this theory, there are no parameters which have dimensions of length. Under a scale of all lengths, the volume increases like the scale factor to the fourth power, both time, scales like length, so on. And so this is scale invariant under rescaling of all lengths, all times, all energies, and E is dimensionless. It's just a pure number in these units. So this theory is scale invariant. In fact, it's more, it's conformally invariant. The full symmetry of this action is SO 4, 2, which is Lorentz transformations plus scaling of position plus special conformal transformations, inversions. So that's for electrodynamics in the vacuum, which is very trivial. It's even trivial to quantize this theory. This is essentially a theory of non-interacting, infinite denumerable number of non-interacting harmonic oscillators, and if you Fourier transform it, and can be easily, you can easily construct a Hilbert space that describes the quantum mechanics of E and M in the vacuum. Now, and this was the first quantum field theory that was attacked after the birth of quantum mechanics. Electrodynamics existed, very successful classically, but it obviously had to be quantized and was already, in a sense, quantized by Einstein applying Planck's ideas to radiation. So coupled to electrons, which were also described by fields, I'm not going to describe matter here, so I'm not going to go into fermionic fields and describe electrons and the Dirac equation, but coupled to matter, electrodynamics was no longer so linear because of the coupling. The quantum mechanical effects, pictorially we say that two light rays, described here by these wavy lines or the quanta particle description of these fields, can interact by creating pairs, so-called virtual pairs, in the vacuum of charged particles like electrons, which then rescatter. And these effects were a challenge for actually something like 30 years to really control and calculate for a lot of technical reasons. But in the case of electrodynamics, that was worked out quite successfully and has led to the most extraordinary tests of fundamental physics that have ever been calculated. For example, the electron, which has spin 1/2, so it's has an intrinsic rotation, also, because of its charge, has an intrinsic magnetic moment, which is measured in some dimensional units by what's called G, and which, for a relativistic electron not interacting with the electromagnetic field is 1. And it was a deviation, the measured deviations of this from 1 that led to the necessity to develop QED as a quantum theory. And it is now measured to 12-digit point. So this is the actual measured value of the intrinsic magnetic moment of the electron, 1.001159652180.85, and the last two digits are uncertain, to plus or minus 76. This is the experimental value. It's quite unbelievable that experimentalists can perform a measurement of this little magnet to one part in a trillion. Not only that, I don't really need to write the theoretical value, which again is a calculational tour de force, because it agrees up to this point with a measured value. In fact, you can't really test at this level of accuracy experiment in theory, because we don't know the fine structure constant, the parameter that enters into this theory, to sufficient precision. In fact, you can turn it around and use the experiment to get one of the best determinations of the fine structure constant. Now, this is the case, even though nobody's ever proven the existence of QED as a quantum version of electromagnetism coupled to electrons. We don't believe it actually exists. And two, this, and finally, this is the result of an expansion in powers of this fine structure constant with coefficients, call them GM, which we believe, although again nobody's proved, go like n factorial for large n. And therefore, this series that we're summing to get this number that has zero radius of convergence. So here is a good example of why mathematicians and physicists find it hard to communicate. We're talking QED, which I haven't really described, because I haven't told you how to couple these gauge fields, E and B, to matter. Doesn't really exist, we believe, for good physical reasons. The same reasons we believe that Yang-Mills theory, non-abelian Yang-Mills theory, does exist. Furthermore, even if it existed, we don't really know how to calculate. The only handle we really have is this perturbative expansion in powers of this very small number, luckily small. And we have good reasons to believe, physical reasons, as well as analogies to other quantum field theories with the same structure, which definitely have this divergent behavior, that these perturbative expansions we use to one part in a trillion have zero radius of convergence. What? We don't know that. We don't know that either. But anyway, I'm not going to complicate. Whether it's n or n factorial, n over 2 factorial, 0, 1. So this is, you know, in a sense, the most spectacular example of the ability of physics to quantitatively make predictions that can be tested and agree. It's a test of the basic. But it's an example where we don't actually believe the theory makes any sense without further input, which I haven't told you about, or the method of calculation is under control. Now, the Well, let me just, yeah. Well, you know the answer to this. So the reason, so what this, the way we look at this nowadays is that when we say here the existence of Young-Mills theory, what is being asked in the Clay Prize, is something that most quantum field theorists, most physicists would say today is much too much to ask. What we really are interested in is not quantum field theory, but effective field theory. Which means that, you see, quantum field theory assumes the existence of fields, functions of points in space-time, and here in the formulation of the field, now this actually depends on space-time, so does this. Here we're taking products of fields at the same point. Now, it turns out that such products are extremely singular, which is one of the technical difficulties of the theory. But the fact that we have products of fields at the same point means that we're really taking these points seriously. We're really saying that we believe that physics is formulated in a continuum where we can bring objects, fields, together arbitrarily closely. Now, we have no evidence for that because at best we can, you know, look a few centimeters with our eyes, microscopes, accelerators. We can go down to distances of 10 to the minus 18 centimeters. But there's a long way between 10 to the minus 18 and zero, especially on a logarithmic scale. And it is a bit of hubris to say that I should imagine that physics is described by a field, quantum field theory, which is assuming that it makes sense to talk about these physical objects down to arbitrarily small distances. Sorry? Well, we actually don't, in fact. But anyway, so the modern point of view would be to say, let's be more humble. And, you know, and put in some cutoff. Not at zero, but at the smallest distance that we've probed, we've seen nothing destroy the point-like structure of space-time, but there might be. And then that removes a lot of problems and allows us to define a theory with a cutoff, destroying, if you want, the continuum at very short distances. For example, replacing the continuum by a set of discrete points, as we will shortly do with, in order to define Young-Mills theory, with a lattice. What we've learned is that if the cutoff, say, is at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, to choose an arbitrary distance, it's not going to affect physics much up here, at these much larger distances. And the non-existence of QED that we'll get to later occurs at distances which turn out to be, let's say, in distance scale, a cutoff of E to the minus 1 over alpha times some standard distance scale, say, if you want, the radius of the electron, distance scale defined by the size of the electron. It's 10 to the minus 11 centimeters. So this is, you know, E to the minus 137, extraordinarily short distance, much, much smaller than anything that occurs here. This is where the problems we run into will kill us, we believe, from showing that this QED, the simple abelian gauge theory, exists as a well-defined theory. And furthermore, that's fine. So we don't have to worry about the theory existing. A much less ambitious theory, one that is cut off at some incredibly short scale, doesn't affect measurements we do at much larger scales, does exist. And we can argue that its asymptotic expansion is perfectly valid for measurements done at large scales, and that this, albeit although not convergent, is asymptotic. So this is an asymptotic expansion in which, you know, if these coefficients gn go like n factorial, until we get to the to n of order 1 over alpha, this should give better and better results, like asymptotic expansions tend to do. And that the errors, the inherent errors we make, will be of order e to the, well, alpha to the, to the order 1 over alpha. So until we get to this, is to get this result, you have to work to fourth order, I think. What? Four loops. And until you get to order, you know, maybe 100 loops, are you going to have a problem? Nobody's ever going to do that. So you can use asymptotic expansions. Where you don't have any rigorous control over the errors, and you can't make the precision arbitrarily good. And furthermore, the sicknesses that prevent this theory from really existing occur only at some incredibly high cutoff. And we know for many reasons that there will be other physical effects, other phenomena coming in, which will change things at these high energies. Now, Yang-Mills theory, which I'm coming to now, we're going to demand much more from. One, we actually, for much the same reasons we believe that electromagnetism as a complete quantum field theory taken to arbitrarily short distances doesn't exist. We believe, and that's the first part of the proof, that non-abelian gauge theories, even just vacuum non-abelian gauge theories, which are highly non-trivial, do exist. And you could really go to arbitrarily short distances. It's a complete theory. You don't have to regard it just as a large distance approximation to something you don't know about, so you cut it off. And second of all, it has this remarkable fact of producing a scale, which this theory in the vacuum doesn't have, dynamically, quantum mechanically. So we're going to be discussing the non-abelian version of electromagnetism. It's just like electromagnetism naively has no scale, as a dimensionless coupling, and yet will produce a scale, a mass gap, from quantum effects. Now, what does it really mean to construct or define or prove the existence of a quantum field theory? since nobody really has ever done it, except in very trivial examples, or in examples where the symmetries are so strong that certain parts of the quantum field theory can be explicitly constructed using the large symmetry, the integrability. It's difficult to really explain this in great detail. But there are certain features that are necessary of any quantum theory. One needs a Hilbert space. States in a Hilbert space. One wants the Hilbert space to have certain a positive metric, positive norm states, because our interpretation of quantum mechanics requires, you know, identifies probability with a norm of states, and probability should be positive. Yes. It's sort of trivial. It's not integrable, and that's right. So it's a theory. Right. Indeed. So there have been theories in less than four dimensions, like phi 4 theory, which from the point of, from our point of view don't have these dimensionless couplings. They have dimensional couplings like masses or nonlinear couplings with dimensions of mass. And those are simple enough at short distances that one can actually prove the existence of the theory. Now, as I said, those don't teach you anything interesting about the structure of quantum field theories. We need to describe nature. But they, you know, they're very difficult pieces of work, and you know, they took a lot of effort. It doesn't appear, however, that that effort allows you to address these more difficult methods, more difficult theories. And I'll say what's been done for four-dimensional theories, but not much. So anyway, we also, most important, we want relativistic invariance. So we have a symmetry, much like classical E&M, Lorentz invariance, in fact, Poincaré invariance, which is translations of space and time, plus Lorentz transformations, which is, we're not dealing with fermions, just SO3. And in quantum mechanics, such symmetries of our theory are represented by operators. So we want unitary operators that under which states and the operators, the fields that transform covariantly, and we want a vacuum, a state that is invariant under Lorentz transformations and translations. The ground state of the system should be symmetric. These are properties that are naively true and true using our limited tools to solve for quantum field theories, but should be true of what we're looking for. We also want that the generators of these symmetry transformations, which are for translations, the momenta, energy and momenta, are have definite spectral properties. So in particular, the energy which is the generator, the Hermitian operator in this Hilbert space should have a spectrum which is bounded from below. The vacuum is invariant, so the vacuum has zero energy, zero momentum. It's translationally and time under time and spatial translations invariant. And in fact, representation theory of the Lorentz group tells us that states that transform irreducibly under the Lorentz group are characterized by momenta and other discrete labels, and the Casimir, the energy squared, minus the momentum squared is what we call the mass. The particle now, if we look at electromagnetism, this theory here, we have a unbroken conformal invariance or scale invariance under scale transformations, length scale up, energy scale down. So in the case of E and M, the spectrum of the energy is continuous. But in that's not what we observe if we ignore the existence of light rays, photons. We see particles of definite mass. Particles, the mass is just the energy of a particle whose momentum is zero. Okay? And the spectrum of the energy for a theory of which we're going to be discussing particular, the spectrum of the mass operator has a discrete state, the vacuum, with zero mass, zero energy, zero momentum. And then the lowest particle mass, a discrete state, with some mg. G standing for gap. And then, for sure, pairs of these particles with twice the mass and some extra kinetic energy, a continuum of multiparticle states. So in a quantum field theory, where we have massive particles and no massless particles like light rays, there is a gap between the vacuum, the ground state, and the first state that can be created with a minimal energy equal to the mass of that particle. And then multiparticle states, perhaps other isolated discrete particle states as well. And it's this gap that is the issue, the really interesting dynamical issue in the second part of this problem. How to produce Hao Yang-Mills theories, which classically will have roughly the same structure as that as electromagnetism and classically have scale invariance and managed to produce a mass gap in the spectrum of the energy operator. But anyway, in order to construct a quantum field theory, you'd like to have a Hilbert space, you'd like to have states that are representations of the transform covariantly under Poincaré transformations, We'd like to have some kind of field operators that depend on space and time, that transform covariantly under Lorentz transformations. You'd like to be able to define matrix elements of products of these operators. And so on. But that is a lot of problems. Sorry. No? Well, the fact that you're here, you have a, so you're made out of, let me come a moment to theory. Well, let's take one of these theories, which is representative of the class of theories that falls into the clay problem. QCD is an example of a, sorry? Goes to zero as what? In what it goes to zero? Sorry, the gap is the so in any quantum field theory where you have you know this setup, there's a gap. I mean, there is a well-defined lowest energy state in the spectrum of P naught above orthogonal to the vacuum. And that might be zero. It is in quantum electrodynamics. In quantum electrodynamics, one has the vacuum, and then a single light ray can have an energy equal, you know, to its frequency, and you can have as low frequency as you want, arbitrarily long wavelength. So the one photon state has any energy starting with zero all the way up to infinity. Two photon state has any energy starting with zero. So you just have a continuum, which is what you'd expect because, after all, there's no scale in the theory. There are no periodic boundary conditions. Oh, you mean, sorry, if you put the theory in a box. Oh, I see. Well, we're not in a box. We're an R3-1. Now, when Yang-Mills theory, so Yang-Mills theory, briefly speaking, is exactly the same action, except we now have a, this is a connection now on some bundle, some gauge group, and SU3 is the relevant gauge group for the real world for QCD. But this problem is stated for any gauge group. But this is now not an abelian gauge group, and the field strength is nonlinear in the gauge field. And that transforms covariantly under gauge transformation. And the action involves the trace, the quadratic form in the Lie algebra of the same beast, but that is now has quadratic terms and cubic terms and quartic terms in the field strength in the equations of motion, which are now dF or dF plus are nonlinear. But again, naively, this coupling is dimensionless. And this theory classically is invariant not just under Poincaré transformations, but under conformal transformations and scale invariants. And so classically, although it's very hard to, you know, the equations of Yang-Mills equations classically are almost as complicated as Einstein's equations, although somewhat simpler. Still, it's clear that the spectrum is continuous. Under scale transformations, the energy scales, and the theory is invariant. So. Now, when Yang-Mills theories were first proposed in the 1950s as a generalization of electromagnetism, because people had discovered approximate, as it turns out, but symmetries, non-abelian symmetries of nuclear particles. One of the reasons why it was so difficult to imagine applying these to the real world was the fact that there weren't any particles with a continuous spectrum like this, except for the photon. So the only long-range, arbitrarily light particles that exist, which are the origin of the long-range force, are believed to be photons, light rays, or gravitons, which we're ignoring the quanta of Einstein's theory. If you look at this classical theory, it would be a continuous spectrum. There would be some kind of nonlinear waves, which would be like electromagnetism, except that they do interact. Two waves cannot be superimposed to get another solution of Yang-Mills equations. It's a horribly nonlinear theory, but just because the symmetry includes scaling of the energies, clearly there's a continuous spectrum. And quantum mechanics, that gives rise to long-range interactions. And the forces that one was trying to describe, namely the strong and weak so-called nuclear forces that act within the nucleus, They're short-range. And if they're going to be described by quantum fields, and it wasn't obvious, by the way, back then the quanta of those fields, the spectrum of the Hamiltonian of the energy, would have to have a gap. The gap, in fact, the value of this gap, this mass, is related to the range of the force, 1 over the range of the force mediated by such, by particles of this mass. So this was a problem for trying to apply gauge theories to the real world. Now, it was solved in two different ways. In the case of the weak interaction, by the so-called Higgs mechanism that you all heard about, whose final form has been verified. In the case of the weak interaction, you add new degrees of freedom, another field, the Higgs field, which you arrange so that classically its minimal energy state breaks the underlying symmetry here. And in that vacuum state, it turns out these broken scale invariants, you introduce the scale for sure, but you also create a gap, classically, very simply. It's a classical mechanism. Doesn't require quantum mechanics. And in fact, most of us, I must say, 40 years ago, were somewhat suspicious that such a cheap solution could explain the weak nuclear force. But it turned out to be the cheapest classical solution, survives quantum mechanically, it explains the weak nuclear force. That's the so-called Higgs mechanism. But what you've done is, you know, you've added something else with new parameters, you've broken this scale conformal symmetry by hand, and you generated a mass gap. And then you can treat the theory much like electromagnetism, calculate perturbatively with divergent expansions, correlated of corrections, and they work. Does the theory exist? Well, probably not. It's mixed with electromagnetism. It's really a SU2 cross U1 gauge theory, whose diagonal U1 is preserved, and that's electromagnetism. And as such, together with this Higgs field, probably doesn't strictly exist either, but nobody cares because we all know that at some cutoff, someplace the physics is going to change, and we can use that approximate theory way below the cutoff. But then there's the strong interaction. And that is a purely that explanation here of why the force is short range and why the basic particles, the basic quanta of this field and the quarks, which I haven't and won't discuss, but these light rays of SU3 gauge group are not observable, which is another property of the theory which I won't discuss called confinement. That is a consequence of rather surprising and beautiful quantum structure of QCD. And it's also the reason we believe that this, among all these other examples, is a theory which actually does exist without any cutoff down to arbitrarily short distances. Again, it's somewhat academic because there is new physics that will come in from here, from these other forces, and ultimately from gravity. So who needs an exact, complete, mathematically rigorous theory? Anyway, it's nice to have one. What? Mathematicians. Which is why they should prove that it exists. So, let's discuss QCD a bit. So QCD is classically as described by this connection on an SU3 bundle with a non-abelian field strength and classically nonlinear equations. Now, classical Yang-Mills theory has been studied a bit, but it's complicated, it's nonlinear, and it's also unobservable. You know, classical electromagnetism is something we use all the time in the real world. And that's actually because there is no mass gap. So it's easy to excite photons, lots of photons. And the quantum mechanics of quanta of light are well described by classical fields when the number of photons is very big. And you can easily construct states with lots, in fact, an infinite number of photons without requiring an infinite amount of energy. But that's not true once there's a gap. So then you need a minimum amount of energy to construct one quanta. and a very large frequency. Remember, the energy is like a frequency. And if the minimal energy is about the minimal energy of what would be the lightest state of in QCD, vacuum QCD, that minimum frequency would be something like 10 to the minus 24 hertz. Now, it's pretty hard to shake something and create a classical chromodynamic field. I mean, we don't know how to do it, and it's a sort of unimaginable that there's any regime, a macroscopic phenomena, that is described by classical QCD. Just because of this gap. Okay. Yuck. So anyway, let me not try to describe any more proving the existence of a theory is. Let me write down the answer that we the answer to the theory as we use it. One of the reasons we believe in the positive answer to this problem is that this theory works in two ways. One, there are predictions of this theory which give can be calculated using this kind of expansion as before, where these coefficients grow like n factorial. But these are functions of dialable physical quantities like the momenta and energy of beams in these big colliders. And it turns out that, albeit an asymptotic expansion, whose coefficients grow like n factorial, the couplings here depend on the scale of the phenomena being measured. And for large enough momenta or energies, these couplings can become, in principle, arbitrarily small. So one has an asymptotic expansion with a parameter that can be physically made as small as you want, in principle, by going to high enough energies. And so, although this, so as long as you take P bigger and bigger, these coefficients, alpha, will get smaller. In principle, you have predictions that get better and better as you make do experiments at higher and higher energies. So that's one reason, and you know, there are zillions and zillions of predictions. They are used all the time in calculating processes for the LHC. They're the background, the uninteresting things. But the ability to calculate that background and for those calculations to work give extraordinary tests of the theory. So that's one reason we believe that this theory exists and its predictions are valid, and that these perturbative expansions make sense. Now, by the way, one way that hasn't been used so far of constructing the theory, which might in the end turn out to be a proof of both the existence and its properties, is to make mathematical sense out of these divergent expansions. Much like you can make mathematical sense out of other asymptotic series in, for mathematical objects, if you can control the various singularities you get when you construct Borel transforms or other things. There is, in fact, a revived interest in making physical sense out of such expansions. And that might be actually a way of a different way than people typically use to define the theory and prove its existence. But the way people use to prove, from a physicist's point of view, the existence of a mass gap, and to calculate the mass gap, which is the same as calculating the spectrum of the theory, the masses of elementary particles, is to define the physical observables in terms of a truncated, cut-off, discretized version of the theory, and then take a limit. So this relies on path integrals, which physicists use all the time to derive beautiful mathematical results and have really no mathematical basis at all, except as limits of finite dimensional integrals. So in the case of gauge theory, one needs to replace this action, which is usually in a path integral. I knew this was going to happen. There's so much. So in quantum mechanics, briefly speaking, the basic entities which are products of fields or products of fields at space-time points can be calculated by integrals, so-called path integrals, integrals over the basic field variables of a phase, which is just the action of those field variables, and then the operators expressed as functionals of those field variables. Such path integrals can only be really defined for quantum mechanical systems with a finite number of degrees of freedom. And in the infinite dimensional case, in order to get a the beginnings of a well-defined expression, one first rotates time to imaginary time, or R31 to R4, replaces Minkowski space by Euclidean space. And then there is a well-defined procedure for having calculated these so-called correlation functions in Euclidean space of going backwards to the so-called Whiteman functions, or the objects that one can use to construct a Hilbert space and the physical observables of a quantum field theory. The reason one does that is that one then has a real measure here, and one can think of evaluating this integral numerically. But one needs to first replace this product over functions by a ordinary integral of product over variables at each space-time point on some lattice that approximates four-dimensional space. And to do that, one has to introduce some kind of discretization of space-time with a lattice separation. And then the action will depend on the fields and on this lattice spacing. Now, in the case of non-abelian gauge theories, or gauge theories in general, the variables are these connections. A connection really tells you how to transport a field, gives you a holonomy from one point to another, from the transformation of the group at one point to that of another. And so, in the lattice definition of gauge theories, the basic variables live on these links and are unitary operators. So one has some kind of lattice in four dimension. The field strength. The curvature tells you what happens if you do parallel transport around a little loop. So the field strength is defined on a plaquette, a little square, and will be the product of these unitary operators in the group around this little plaquette. And what replaces this action is just so this is a unitary matrix that describes what happens when you go around a little plaquette. And this is summed over all plaquettes. So for each plaquette, you have, so in a sense, U of a link is the parallel transport along the link of the gauge connection. And UP, if you work this out, is roughly something like the exponential of I times F dx mu dx nu, where this plaquette is in the mu nu direction. If I sum over all plaquettes, take the trace of F is 0, the first term that survives here is the sum roughly over all plaquettes of a to the fourth F to the fourth F squared plus terms of order a to the sixth. And this is just, if a becomes arbitrarily small, the same as this integral. So this is a discretization of the action. And in terms of these plaquette variables, which are products of link variables, and one integrates over all links on the lattice with Haar measure, this is bounded. And for a finite lattice, a finite number of links, this certainly is a well-defined integral. The idea is that as this lattice expands to fill all of space and become finer and finer, this should, up to terms which are irrelevant, vanish like powers of a squared compared to this term. This is like the integral over space of trace F wedge F. These higher order terms have extra powers of a in them and naively go to zero. But this will define a continuum theory. Now I've gone through this much. Unless you've seen this before, you'll never understand it. But essentially, you replace space-time by a lattice of points in space-time. You might put in periodic boundary conditions. That helps numerically. So you do this on a torus. And then you want to use this as a well-defined measure to calculate correlation functions of operators. And the only problem is that you have to carefully choose this coupling that appears here as the analog of the fine structure constant, to depend on the lattice spacing as well. Now, the remarkable property of non-abelian gauge theories is how you have to choose the coupling dependence on A, on the cutoff, as you take the cutoff to zero. So you want to take this whole thing in the limit where this lattice of points, you know, fills up the space and A goes to zero. The famous divergences and ultraviolet divergences and interesting dynamical behavior of quantum field theories has to do with the behavior of a as you let the continuum or the let the lattice spacing or the cutoff go to zero. And here is where the big difference between a theory like QED and a theory like QCD happens. And so in QCD, there is a definite prescription that you must take as A goes to zero in order for this limit to exist. And that requires that the coupling defined on this lattice of scale A vanishes like 1 over log A times some parameter of dimensions. Actually, let me define it as 1 over A lambda. As A goes to zero, this blows up. So this vanishes like 1 over log. And lambda is an arbitrary parameter of dimensions 1 over length or mass that you introduce to define this limit. Now, what we know is that if you evaluate a correlation function using this measure by perturbation theory, by expanding around the Gaussian fixed point, the point at which this is quadratic, then you can perturbatively calculate all of these sums, and that is known as perturbation theory. And in that perturbative limit, you can prove that if you let G squared vanish, coupling that at a scale A vanish logarithmically in this fashion, then term by term in that expansion, all physical observables are finite. Furthermore, even though those perturbative expansions are asymptotic, you can always go to small enough A where this behavior makes G as small as you want. So that means you would think you could trust an asymptotic expansion. And if the coupling isn't small enough, you just make the lattice a little bit smaller, and then it gets better and better. So there's strong reasons to believe that this so-called asymptotic freedom, the vanishing of the coupling, which governs the scale of interactions at distance A, vanishes as A goes to zero, that is what's necessary to make this limit exist. That, in a sense, is what needs the first thing that needs to be proved, that the limit exists. The limit exists for using this measure, of course, inserting in here some appropriate product of observables formulated in terms of these lattice approximations to the field strength. Now, if you could prove that that limit exists, then you could probably also prove all the properties of the correlation functions, the correlation functions of various operators that you need to satisfy the constructive axioms of quantum filtering. Yeah, the existence of a unique vacuum represents. You'd have to prove that the theory possesses the symmetry, the Lorentz invariance of the original theory, which you've broken by putting the theory on a lattice. All you have are a discrete subgroup of the Lorentz group, the rotation group, and translation invariance. That, too, we believe is true, because the terms that violate Lorentz invariance are these terms which have extra powers of lattice spacing. And order by order and perturbation theory, if you do this by saddle point, order by order in the saddle point approximation, they do indeed vanish like powers of A. So order by order in this asymptotic expansion that gets better and better as you go to smaller and smaller lattices, everything works. But that's not a proof that the limit exists. For physicists, it's sort of a proof. But it's not a mathematical proof. And now, there has been some progress by some, by Balaban and some other constructive field theorists who got pretty far, I think, for non-abelian gauge theory in a finite box. So in a finite box, you keep the size of the system, of the torus, if you want, fixed as you take the lattice space into zero. And from a physical point of view, that makes the job a lot easier. Because one, you, in a finite box, you don't have this problem of a continuum. You have discrete states. And you never get to a region. You can make the box small enough so the asymptotic expansion is better and better. And you can put in bounds and control, try to control the limit. But even there, nobody really isn't a proof of the existence, even in a box that I know of. And the papers are really possible to read. And by and large, work has stopped on that effort, as far as I know, in the last decade. Now, that's just the first part, proving the limit exists. The next part is actually proving that there's a mass gap. And there, what you have to do is do what people do anyway, which is calculate the mass spectrum of this theory. And they do that. And one of the reasons we believe in the theory beyond just the perturbative asymptotic expansion is that by doing the numerical integration, Monte Carlo integration of these integrals, and then trying to take the limit for bigger and bigger lattice, they can calculate the masses. And the find that as you take this limit, g squared vanishes like 1 over a, you've introduced some parameter with dimensions of mass, 1 over length, and that the masses you calculate, and there's a specific procedure for doing that, are finite and are numbers, depending on the state, ms, it's a pure number, in units of this arbitrary scale that you've introduced to define this limit. Now, you say, what is the scale? I don't know. Let's put it equal to 1. We have nothing to compare it with because this theory has no scale. So when you have a theory that you've introduced the scale in this way to define the theory, then all masses are numbers times the scale. That's what we call dimensional transmutation. We've traded this dimensionless number for a dimensionful number. And it makes no meaning to say what the value of this is. It simply is what it is. Take one of these masses, one of these particles, say the one in the real world, we might take the proton, and call it mass one. And then all other masses, particle one, particle two, the ratios will just be pure numbers. And this is what people then calculate and compare with experiment. And by now, after 30 years or more of doing these calculations, massive effort, we have calculated the spectrum of all the low-lying hadrons, particles made out of mostly quarks, which I haven't talked about here. But if in pure QCD, which we can't compare with experiment, it would be the masses of particles made out of these interacting quanta of the gauge field to one, and they agree with experiment to about 1% accuracy. There are various ways of estimating the theoretical errors as well, but there's nothing rigorous about this. One, nobody's ever shown the limit exists, and two, nobody has a rigorous way of controlling these errors. However, we have enough, you know, every state that exists in nature appears in the spectrum. There are no states with zero mass, so there's a gap, indeed, numerically. And that's why we believe the answer should be, yes, this limit exists. And yes, if one calculates the spectrum of the energy, there's a gap. And an interesting spectrum. So, unfortunately, I didn't have time to discuss this remarkable phenomena, which is the basis of this. The fact, if you ask, why, what about QED, or quantum electrodynamics, you discover, order by order in perturbation theory, you have to arrange for this coupling as a function of lattice spacing to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Which one means you don't trust what you're doing because perturbation expansion begins to diverge. And two, every indication is that before you reach the continuum limit, before you get to zero, this parameter blows up and you lose all sense of what you're doing. Doesn't mean that this theory, that QED, doesn't describe the real world. We know it does. But something's missing. You need other ingredients. You might need one or two other ingredients. It might be part of string theory. It might be part of a bigger unified theory. It might be involve an infinite number of parameters. We have no idea all by itself. It just means that it's not what we would call a UV complete theory that's extendable to arbitrarily short distances. In fact, in four dimensions, we believe that the only theories that have a chance of existing in this sense are these very special theories. And those are all contained in the definition of the Clay problem. So these aren't just any old quantum field theories. They, one, describe the real world. Two, they're the only theories that manage to do all these miracles, and therefore they deserve a proof that everything we know is true actually is. Thank you. So, the mathematicians have any questions? I'm sure many. Yeah, sure.
You started off by talking about U1. You started off by talking about U1
and how from the mathematical point of view, it's a sick theory in some ways.
If extended to arbitrarily short distances.
Yes. But then, of course, you wrote down g over 2 to 13 or 14 decimal places, right? Would you say, this has to do with the connection between math and physics, I guess, would you say that g over 2 is it a number in the sense of mathematics?
No.
Because it's not defined at the 137th place or something, right? Could you say that's a...
There is a measurement.
Real number? Yeah.
Yes,
go ahead.
Physically, there is a number, but mathematically, it's a number in some theory. We don't know what it is yet. Whereas the ratio of masses of particles I discussed here, by the way, vacuum QCD, if you want. QCD with no matter, no quarks, just the nonlinear interacting fields, which themselves are charged, so they're very complicated. And in the real world, they're also quarks, and that introduces other parameters, unfortunately. But if we didn't have those quarks, and we just had this theory, there are these numbers, which are not going to be simple rational numbers or anything, you know, mathematically nice, but they are numbers, infinite set of numbers. QCD, this QCD without matter, you see, started out with one dimensionless parameter. It looked like a free number you could put in. It ends up with a scale. A scale which means nothing, because you have nothing to compare it with. So all dimensionless measurable quantities in QCD are calculable numbers. So mathematically, they're kind of interesting. All these numbers are pure numbers, and they depend on the gauge group, G. And nothing else. So in the gauge, if the gauge group is SUN, they have an interesting dependence on N, for example, one which we exploit because life does get simpler if N is big. But they're just numbers that are characteristic of the gauge group. If one had some really powerful mathematical way of describing this dynamics, they might turn out to be very interesting mathematically. Certainly, from a physics point of view, there are very few theories we have in physics that have such a rich and powerful structure, where there are an infinite set of quantities that are just numbers, theory determines.
I have a naive question. The existence of mass gap, does it have anything to do with the non-abelian nature of the gauge group?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, remember, there's only one abelian theory with a compact group, right? And, it doesn't have a mass gap, for sure. It has a continuous spectrum. So, this has to do, there are ways of, so the abelian theory is trivial. It's too trivial to have a gap in the vacuum. It's just free waves with continuous spectrum. Non-abelian theory is an interacting theory, and there are lots of ways of understanding where the gap comes from, the dynamics that creates these massive bound states. But it's not like there are many abelian theories. And all non-abelian theories should have this the same behavior. Right. Well, you know, it also, so it's ambitious in the sense that it doesn't, you know, it requires the real world as opposed to less than four dimensions, which makes life easier, or extra symmetries like supersymmetry that make life easier. And it also, but it takes the easy way out. It doesn't ask for this to be true on the arbitrary manifold. But we have very good reasons to believe that if quantum field theory exists on flat space, with a flat metric, that small deformations, at least small deformations of the background geometry, aren't going to change anything. Because all the problems occur, you know, in the vicinity at very short distances. So as long as you deform the geometry in a way that's smooth, then you're not going to have a problem. That, again, is a folk theorem, but one that is surely true. So this would be the starting point. Now, the applications of quantum field theory, which have been of great interest to mathematicians, and I suppose they would like to have some firm foundation for some of those applications, often have, you know, don't work in flat space. They work with some curved manifold. But as long as the curvature is, you know, smooth, then locally the theory is flat, and it won't change. So I would imagine that once, if you had methods powerful enough to prove the existence for flat space, you could prove it on an arbitrary smooth Riemannian manifold. Well, but you know, like in this definition, you don't really use the. What you use is that you break the Lorentzian symmetry in defining the object. You recover it in the limit. It's hard, much harder. Especially if you have some, you know, the global structure of space-time is different than Minkowski space. I mean, then we get black holes, you know, all these problems.